is Sustainable East End. With co-producer Tony Ernst, I'm Francesca Rhiannon. South Fork architect and planner Bill Chaliff of Chaliff & Rogers in Watermill is known for his leadership in designing energy-efficient homes and buildings. 6 years ago, we spoke with Chaliff about his ideas about cleaning our water supply and how the settlement pattern on the East End impacts the options to clean our environment. This week, Sustainable East End co-producer Tony Ernst spoke with Chaliff again about his work and his ideas about town planning and what still needs to be done to fix our water supply.
Bill Chaliff, welcome back to Sustainable East End.
Tony, very happy to be here. Thank you.
It's been actually 6 years since we last spoke on Sustainable East End, and the topics we covered are still pertinent, including energy-efficient homes, zoning and open space, the need for more affordable housing, and the poisoning of the estuaries and wildlife in them by our individual household septic systems.
First, let me say, over 6 years is a difference, a big difference between then and today, and that is 6 years ago, people who were discussing these same issues were on the outside. We were the little voices crying in the wilderness, and none of these issues were on the mainstream table or in any public forum in general terms, and had not attracted the attention of politicos and pundits and so forth. And today I'm happy to report that every single one of these issues is a mainstream topic of concern, and not just in on the East End, but actually across the country. These same issues are plaguing most towns and villages all the way across the country for various reasons in those places. But nonetheless, that's a tremendous progress that this culture has shifted to allow for these to be addressed by those who can do something about it. We continue to work on green homes. We're very fortunate in that people are contacting us. We don't have to reach out or explain to people who contact us as just another architectural firm that this is something that we have a deep history with, but this is our 47th year in practice, and we really know what we're doing. So we have some projects, we have some new homes, we have some renovations, but we're also working on some public buildings for the town. We're doing a renovation of the Tiana Lifeguard Station, which was staffed entirely by African Americans for one period. So it has an interesting cultural aspect to it as well. But of course, we have to honor with that building historic guidelines for the preservation of existing building elements. But within those parameters, we're doing everything we can to make the building green, which means low energy use, using sustainable materials, having an agenda for durability and other requirements.
Bill Chaliff told Sustainable East End that green building means getting all the different elements of the build together, the architect, the contractor, the subcontractors, and the owner. And it even starts before that, before the land itself has been purchased.
For example, you may say to me, Bill, I'm looking to do a new house, and I've got a lot somewhere out here on the East End, and I'll bring you the survey and we'll take a look. Well, already you have decided by selecting the lot, 80% of the issues and with their inherent solutions or problems by selecting that lot. It would be best if you get myself, a builder, some of the main subs and contractors and consultants together, and we sit at a table and you say, you know, I'm looking for a new house for myself and my wife and my family. What do you guys think we should do? And we could say, well, there is the option of the single family house, but have you considered maybe an apartment or some other form, or doubling up, building a two family house and taking care of either parents or children's needs at the same time, and looking at this thing in a bigger, broader way, and coming down to bear on where would be the best place. Do you want to be dependent on an automobile? Do you really think that having your lot off on a farm 5 miles from the nearest village would be the best for how you choose to live your life, or maybe some other pattern. So right at the beginning, if you have all the people who will be in your working in your interest at a table with you from the get-go, you might go off in an entirely different direction, but then you're opening the door to a world of other possibilities that can help you to lower the cost of your housing, improve the quality of your life. And these are the big issues about where you live and what your house form is like. Let's suppose you collect all the cutting-edge technologies that impact energy in this case, and you integrate them into a little house, and that house is on with a magnificent view on perhaps a waterfront parcel, but with a very long driveway, and in fact, it's maybe 4 miles from the village. The energy that you use in your life in order to live in that building, remote from a village, dwarfs the amount of energy that you save in terms of heating and cooling the building, which is all we can really deal with in this small building. What are the elements of a efficient home? And instead of using fuel oil, how would we go about doing this? And I would ask you to look at the project in this fashion. First of all, we have a demand side, and then we have a supply side. The demand side would be controlling how much energy the building needs. And the first goal is to get those needs way, way down, get what we call the building loads way, way, way down. And that's the major way that we do this is by controlling first the size of the building. The bigger the building, the larger the thermal envelope, meaning the skin, the surface area, and therefore the more the potential for losing our heat through there or picking up extra heat in the summer is greatest. If we then reduce the skin, the amount of square footage, by reducing the envelope size, making the house smaller, then that's the very first thing to do. The next thing to do is upgrade the quality of the thermal envelope or the building skin with insulation. And we do that with the lowest cost or the lowest environmentally impactful insulation that we can think of. And that varies from project to project. But make sure that we minimize the conductive losses through the skin in the winter, and again the gains in the summer. So now we have a load that we've consciously looked to reduce. Then we look at the other side of the coin, which is the supply side. We've dealt with the demand side. Then we go to the supply side, and we have a range of options of fuels. We can use the classic fossil fuels. We can use gas, coal, oil, or we can look at renewables, which are ultimately all solar. They are, in today's market, photovoltaic, which are the panels that convert the sun's daylight energy into electricity. Or we can use wind energy, which are windmills that drive, or wind turbines that drive generators that produce electricity. But the most direct method would be uses of the sun's rays. And there are active solar systems where the house becomes itself a solar collector, a solar machine. And then there are passive solar systems, the so-called the passive solar house, which by far is the cheapest and most economical way to go, and very, very effective. So we would then deploy passive solar technology, which I'll come back to in terms of describing how that works and what it needs. And that might get our loads. It might take 50 to 80% of the load. And then what remains, a very small amount of the load, could be delivered by even fossil fuel, or most likely what we want to do is again use the green technologies, the renewables, which would mean mostly photovoltaics or wind power.
Has there been enough progress with affordable housing on the East End?
Tony, this is a very bad story now. The need, since we last spoke, has increased. The need, according to the projections of the county planning department over 6 years ago, was for a minimum of 5,000 units in Southampton Town. And because East Hampton Town is about half the population, about 2,500 units in East Hampton. And those numbers have just only increased. And we are further and further in the red or in the hole because we've only been providing a trickle of affordable housing. I think in the last 6 years, there's been less than 50 units added in the town of Southampton and less than 25 units added in the town of East Hampton. So we are really sliding backwards. We're losing on this fight. And there first has to be acknowledgement of what the goal is. We don't have anybody that I hear in either town acknowledging that this is the scale of the problem. They say, yes, we have an affordable housing crisis. Well, thank goodness we got that far. But we don't have people who are quick to stand up and assign a number to really give the size of the problem. Because if people are unaware and we just say, well, we're building affordable housing as fast as we can, and look, we did 20 units in this last year, and patting themselves on the back, then they don't understand that we're falling far short and the crisis is increasing every year because they've only done 20 units in the last year when there should have been maybe 200 or 2,000.
Recently, our Assemblyman Fred Thiel proposed funding from a 0.5% real estate transfer tax to be added to the existing tax. So when somebody sells their house, they pay it 2%, but 2.5% of the purchase price into a fund to finance affordable housing.
Well, I think that's a terrific thing. And from what I hear, there's no resistance to that. But the problem with affordable housing is not the cost of the housing. The problem is site acquisition. And on the East End, everybody's battling for, quote, open space, preservation of the unbuilt landscape. And at the same time, the land values are skyrocketing. Not so much because we're taking open space out of off the table, and therefore contributing to the shortage of available sites, but because these large houses are going up everywhere, and the zoning which zoning permits, and causing the real estate values to skyrocket when people are building these huge homes. They are driving up the cost of acquisition, site acquisition, of construction, and of maintenance for you and me. Each home puts into motion an army of maintenance people. That's the trade parade that we see on the roads here and causes our transportation problem. So we still have that, and we have to really change the zoning. And as we go more and more into crisis mode on providing affordable housing, my own thinking has come to a place where I feel that more radical solutions are then required. And I'm really for rezoning all our land back to villages and hamlets in a working, managed landscape, regenerate the healthy agricultural and maritime economies that were the hallmark of our original settlements out here, and tear down those houses. Yes, I'll repeat that. Tear down those buildings and give the owners building credits to rebuild in the villages and the hamlets, and by way of compensating them as fairly as we can, let them build two or three units, multiple units, rather than just one. So even if they occupy only one, they can recover their monies by having several units.
You're listening to Sustainable East End. Co-producer Tony Ernst is talking with South Fork Green architect Bill Chaliff.
6 years ago in 2013, we talked about the degradation of our groundwater and the estuaries by thousands of individual households' septic systems. Where are we on in this?
Well, first, the good news. The good news, again, is that county officials, health officials, other politicians and representatives have acknowledged that we have a problem and have even acknowledged the scale of the problem. For example, Lake Agawam in the heart of the village of Southampton has been designated as the most polluted body of water in all of New York State, right? A wonderful designation I'm sure the village is very proud of. But we can't slip this under the rug anymore and hide it. And everybody's on board with the pollution that's occurring in our estuary system, the bay areas, and even in the ocean. There have been medical waste and other things, you know, washing up on our beaches. Our beaches, our estuary system is the heart of why we are a resort area. It's the heart of our industry and our economy. It's the basis of the second home market. If this fails, if we have beaches that people can't swim on because they're full of medical waste or other damaging products and unhealthful materials that are all over the place, if our groundwater is polluted, our drinking water is polluted, and our fishing is polluted, so the recreational uses and the commercial uses all evaporate, then the entire region's economy will collapse. So people get that now, and that's the good news again. Unlike affordable housing, people are aware of the scale of the problem. On the other side of that, just to flesh out the picture a little better, the septic waste is being labeled as the prime culprit. People thought it was agricultural pollution from nitrogen for fertilization. This turns out to be a very small fraction, or other sources of nitrogen. The primary source of nitrogen, which is causing this pollution, is human waste. Because we have in Suffolk County, the vast amount of the human waste that we create is treated through individual septic systems, half of which were built before 1972. We have over 360,000 individual septic systems in Suffolk County, which is more than in the entire state of New Jersey, half of which were built before 1972, which means that they have, in all likelihood, no septic tanks. So the leaching pools are doing a minimum amount of treatment, and we are pumping. These are become then machines that pump nitrogen into the environment, into the water table, and into the estuary system. So the county, in its infinite wisdom, has decided that we should only be now putting in these new, quote, IA systems, innovative alternative systems, about which 11 are approved different systems from various manufacturers around the world that limit the amount of nitrogen. These systems are more complicated and more expensive, as you might imagine, for each homeowner. And they are machines in one way or another, meaning they are moving parts, they use energy, you have to plug them in, and therefore they also require maintenance. Now, my question is, are we going to take all 360,000 individual systems and replace them with these 360,000 new systems, which are not actually even performing to the degree required? The federal standard for healthy drinking water is no more than 10 milligrams per liter. What an old septic system would do with a septic tank is somewhere around 40 milligrams per liter, and without a septic tank could be 100 or 200 or 500 milligrams per liter. What we need, though, is a system that creates so little nitrogen that it's healthy not just for drinking water, but for our estuary systems, which are the homes, the breeding grounds for all shellfish and finfish. Well, that number is much lower, than, believe it or not, than what good drinking water is. That number is 20 times lower. It's 0.5 milligrams per liter of nitrogen. And therefore, the new systems, which are running at 5 milligrams per liter, are 20 times still higher, even though they meet drinking water standards. They don't meet standards for our healthy estuary system. So at some point, I'm very confident that science will come to our aid, and people are working on this, and they will improve the efficiency of these innovative and alternative systems. But right now, the systems we're putting in are 20 times worse than they ultimately need to be. So at some point, we're going to put in 360,000 new systems. I imagine this is the plan because no one says otherwise, and they're funding people to help them to do this. And then in a few years' time, 5 or 10, we're going to rip them all out and put in the newer, higher-performing ones. And we may not be able to do that in one jump, in one technological jump. We may have to do that twice or three times because we're talking about 20-fold improvement in performance. So I think this is absolutely absurd for many reasons. But the primary reason is that now we're shifting the burden of responsibility to the individual homeowner. Right. If we understand that this is a collective problem, then why don't we handle it with a collective solution? For example, we have a lot of people still using individual wells for the drinking water, but what we're doing is replacing that system with a collective system where we have the Suffolk County Water Authority, which is putting water mains and making water available to every individual homeowner through a system of a distribution tree of pipes that comes from a central source. Well, the same would be true here. Why can't we have a collection system that's a reverse network of piping and collect that and send it to one or a few central treatment plants? Then as the technology for improving denitrification takes place, we can afford to replace 20 or 30 or 50 or 100 of these main stations, as the technology allows, at relatively little cost, instead of 360,000 individual systems at what a mess, ripping up your yard, all your landscaping, parking, and so forth, and replacing that. And having to repair that when you change your septic system out. You know, it just seems like a total idiocy to me, and I think we have to go in and do collection systems. Fortunately, there are new collection systems around, not brand spanking new. We're not guinea pigs, but these systems have been online and working since World War II, where either vacuum systems, which I tend to favor, or small pipe diameter pressure systems, so that we're talking about 2, 3, 4 inch, maybe as large as 6 inch piping that allows the septic to be collected and moved around without using the old system of sewers, which were cast iron gravity systems. In our flat landscape, these don't make sense because they have to work with a pitch. And that means with great frequency, we're installing pumping stations, which are a maintenance and a big cost. So we take out most of the pumping stations with a gravity or pressurized collection system and feed them to a few central processing systems for waste, which we do in the villages and the hamlets anyway now, and we should be doing by cleaning up the entire landscape.
Can we do more about preserving open space?
If we stop calling it open space, that would be a beginning. Open space to me says two things. One, that there's no differentiation or understanding of how that space is to be used. When we say open space, we just imagine what, virgin forests or farmland or what? Just anything other than built. Well, we should differentiate between the uses of our unbuilt environment just the way we differentiate between uses of our built environment. This is a good place for a school. This is a good place for a factory. This is a good place for housing. This is a good place for mixed use and so forth. That's how we look at our mix, our built environment. We should do the same with the unbuilt environment, not just call it open space. The second thing is that use of phrase open space denies anyone's responsibility, ownership or stewardship or care and responsibility for that landscape. I would suggest using the phrase the managed landscape. This means that the space is differentiated. It has functionalities that are we understand are important. And it also means that we take stewardship, we take responsibility for that landscape. Ultimately, what we need to have is a working, managed landscape that maintains an interdependency with the built environment. So we have an unbuilt environment, we have a built environment, and they have an interdependency. The built environment uses products from the unbuilt environment, but also was responsible for the health and the maintenance and the sustainability of the unbuilt environment, and vice versa. So we need to go back to an agricultural base out here instead of a resort base. We need to change the zoning. We have to tear down a lot of what we built because we're in crisis mode. It demands crisis response. And we have to do this, and then we will see lower energy use, we will see sustainability, we will see quality of life going up, we will see the cost of living going down, the environmental impact, negative environmental impact going way down, and we will restore health and quality of life to our communities.
Did we forget anything?
Oh, I'm sure we forgot a lot of details. But at this point, Tony, I think it's really important to set up an alternative large picture. Because right now what politicians do and what the newspapers do is put little pieces in front of us that don't connect everything together. And we don't know how they fit and how they either help us to get to a future place where we want to be or don't help us get to a future place where we want to be. Or even have people think about the concept of how should things be. Most people don't think about that. They just say things are not as good as they were. But when you ask them, well, what should they be like? They go, oh, I don't know. I never thought about that. This is what we have to do. If we set up an alternative picture about what the future looks like, short term, middle term, long term, then the easy problem is reverse engineer a way to get from here to there. If we never create a there, we'll never figure out how to get from here to there.
That was green architect and planner Bill Chaliff of Chaliff & Rogers of Watermill. This is Sustainable East End. A complete version of today's discussion, along with past programs, can be heard online at sustainableeastend.blogspot.com. Sustainable East End is produced by Tony Ernst and me, Francesca Rhiannon.